Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night just with a click of your mouse, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome today Barbara Rose Johnston. She's an anthropologist and resident scholar at the School for Advanced Research. She's the editor of and contributor to the new book, Half Lives, Half Truths, Confronting the Radioactive Legacies of the Cold War. Welcome, Barbara, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. This is a stunning, fascinating, scary book filled with a lot of information that all of us should know. I learned a lot that I didn't know, and I thought I knew something about this subject. How did you get into this work?
That's a good question. Initially, way back in the 1990s, early 1990s, I was asked to help the United Nations pull together a study on human rights and the environment. We were looking at the relationships between gross human rights abuse and environmental degradation, and pulling together cases that illustrated that groups, not just individuals, had rights that were being abused. The strategy was to pull together those kinds of most disgusting cases that so clearly illustrated the points. And one of those cases was the case of the people of Rongelap. People of Rongelap is an atoll in the Marshall Islands where people were heavily exposed to nuclear weapons tests and then enrolled in human subject experiments that went on for decades. So that initial documentation was what led me into the issues in the case studies.
When you say human subject experiments, what do you mean?
At the time, military and national interests in the United States and the Soviet Union and in France and in China all were directed towards how do we fight a nuclear war and how do we win. So the key questions were how can we have people up in an airplane for hours and hours at a time at high altitude? What happens to the body? What happens in terms of detonating a bomb? How soon can we march onto the field and fight? What happens in the long run for people living in a contaminated setting? Some of those questions were best answered by exploring how radiation moves through the food chain and through the human body. And people like the Marshallese were involved in studies to document that.
They had no idea that they were involved in these studies?
They had no idea. They were initially exposed, and they had no idea that in the medical treatment that occurred every 6 months for decades, that the main emphasis was to document what happened to their bodies rather than specifically to treat them. It's a similar controversy in terms of how we responded in Japan to Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors in terms of whether people were treated versus whether people were documented. The U.S. set up an atomic bomb casualty commission that worked with radiation survivors there, and in large part because it represented such a phenomenal scientific opportunity, they had no idea what the long-term consequences of radioactive exposure might be. In terms of the human experience, for those who served as human subjects, the stories are very different than from the scientific benefits that we accrued from those studies.
We think of nuclear weapons deployment as limited to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In your book, you remind us that, including all the above-ground tests, there have been 504 nuclear weapons deployed.
Yeah, from a political standpoint, nuclear weapons have only been used in to end World War II. From a human and environmental standpoint, nuclear war started with Trinity test and has continued ever since. The atmospheric weapons tests especially were detonated in regions and areas where people live. So in certainly Nevada test site, but also in the Marshall Islands, where about 1,000 times more contaminants were released into the atmosphere. Our heaviest and biggest weapons were detonated in the atmosphere there, and people lived downwind. Similarly, in the Soviet Union, tests took place largely in Kazakhstan, in that area, but where human populations were living.
Now, in addition to these tests, which have terrible consequences, which we'll be talking about, there are also the people working in and living near uranium mines. There's also weapons production facilities, and there's also waste dumps.
Great. One of the things we wanted to do in this book was to explore what was the human experience of hosting nuclear militarism, meaning uranium mining, milling, the processing of yellow cake, the production of weapons, the testing of weapons? What was the experience for those people who were scientists, who were documenting the effects of radiation, but also the people who were living in those regions, the workers and the residents? And in this book, because so much information has been made available in the United States, thanks to declassification orders in the 1990s, it was rather easy to pull together the story from a U.S. point of view. It's much more difficult to pull together the Soviet experiences or the Chinese experiences, or especially the French experiences, in part because national security and classification still is the rule of the day. In terms of all of these different areas, what we tried to do was pull together case studies, and this is why it's an edited volume rather than a singular authored book, because anthropologists who've been working on the ground in Hanford around Washington State with Native American tribes, for example, might be able to pull together a more finely tuned analysis of the ins and outs of trying to deal with the radioactive legacies of Hanford than an external author might pull together.
We're talking to Barbara Rose Johnston, and the book is called Half Lives, Half Truths, Confronting the Radioactive Legacies of the Cold War. The great assault of nuclear radiation is invisible. It's also easily denied, and it's huge. Let's talk about the radioactive elements, the byproducts of nuclear reactions, and how they are harmful, how they affect the body.
With atmospheric weapon tests, rather early on, scientists recognized several elements of huge concern. Strontium-90 being one of them. It's an isotope that is a derivative and has about a 20 or so year half-life that adheres to the bone, to the teeth. It acts like calcium in the body.
So it comes into the body. The body thinks, oh, calcium. Let's use calcium.
Exactly. You breathe, you eat, you ingest. You drink milk, and it might be accumulative in milk. One of the important aspects of strontium, similar to cesium-137 and to iodine-131, is that all of these isotopes are bioaccumulative. So that means that if you have an atmospheric release, it will come down, hit the soil, hit the plants, accumulate in the plants. Cows, for example, might graze on that. It would accumulate in the fat tissue and it be at higher doses than what was in the atmosphere in the milk. And then you as a kid growing up in St. George, Utah, for example, would be drinking milk with much higher levels of contaminant in it.
I think it's also really important to talk about the fact that when atmospheric tests are done in one place, these elements might end up in a completely different place.
Yeah, and it's also important to understand that not just atmospheric tests, but subsurface tests. For example, in 1996, in the Lopnor testing facility in China, there was a subsurface test which created a huge plume, and we've got a whole global network of monitoring and tracking air quality. In 3 days, this cloud of radioactive debris blanketed the Earth. In 3 days, it took for this cloud to go around the room. Because of the long-lived nature of many of the isotopes, you can have a cloud from a singular test in the atmosphere degrading and releasing contaminants for decades. In fact, much of the atmospheric cloud that we have around the planet still has the results from atmospheric tests as well as subsurface tests.
What do isotopes like strontium-90 actually do to the body once they're absorbed?
That's a good question. There's been decades and decades of study. There's a whole host of health effects that will result as the body takes in something like strontium-90 or iodine-131, and it thinks, aha, this is a useful bit. Basically, for strontium-90 as something that adheres to the bone, it can also be adhere in our arterial plaque. You have high potential for bone cancers, for leukemias, degradation of the teeth, premature aging, osteoarthritis, degenerative osteoarthritis is one aspect. For iodine-131, The body thinks of it as a salt, and it adheres to the thyroid. So your primary response then would be thyroid hypothyroidism or thyroid cancers. What that means in terms of your metabolism and your growth, if you're exposed in utero or you're a young child, especially if you're a young girl, you have different kinds of effects, not only in terms of how you might grow in the Marshall Islands. Radioiodine meant that most people got thyroid cancer, but it also meant that many of the children who were exposed were stunted, never achieved full growth. Reproductive effects are documented and controversial as to this precise radiogenic causality, but it's certainly a huge issue in all of the regions. It's also important to understand it's not just isotopes released from nuclear weapons testing, but also isotopes released from uranium mining and processing. In the context of uranium mining, radon gases, and as radon gases devolve into their daughters, produce really long-lived isotopes that 20, 25 years down the line might degenerate. And in that 2 or 3 minute deterioration from one form to another, trigger cellular production, abnormal cellular growth, especially in the lungs if you've inhaled radon gases, which is why one of the problems of radiation exposure is that we initially understood that there was an acute, immediate response, but it's this latency effect because of the half-life nature of the isotopes that decades down the line you were presented with problems. And I'll just say one more thing, that in terms of immediate exposure or long-term exposure of the individual, you have a whole set of issues. In terms of what happens to the next generation, that's an area of scientific research that we're just starting to understand, in large part because of Chernobyl and the studies that have been done after Chernobyl.
I think it's also important when we talk about radon to say something that I also wasn't aware of, is that lower level exposures are actually more carcinogenic than higher level exposures.
Yeah, it's one of those bizarre things. Again, the initial science suggested just that humans evolved on a radioactive planet. We have UV sunlight coming in, we have natural sources of radiation, and so initially the understanding was that radiation at a certain level is not only natural, it's a good thing. It's something that helps promote abnormal growth that stimulates and challenges the system. What we've come to understand in the last, especially as documented in the last few years, though pointed out decades ago, is that low-level exposures, it's not just a simple add it all up. The highest levels will give you the worst response. Depends upon the type of isotope, depends upon how it responds to your unique system, as well as whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, whether you're a baby, whether you're pregnant. So all of those are complicating factors in terms of the human health outcome.
And babies are, of course, more vulnerable than adults, and women are more vulnerable than men.
Right. That's right.
We're talking about the book Half Lives, Half Truths with Barbara Rose Johnston. Let's talk also about the health and safety issues. One of the things that I was pretty shocked to read about was that there was and this is part of the half-truths thing, there was a 20-year gap between the government's scientific confirmation of the health risks of radiation and then the implementation of the most basic safety regulations. And in fact, in that 20-year period, in the United States, 1951 to 1971, workers were studied, but they weren't informed that they were being studied and they weren't treated for radiation effects.
Right, and that example particularly pertains to uranium mining. One of the more insidious aspects of that is that at the same time that workers, scientists, technicians, and so forth working in, for example, Oak Ridge, were given health and protection information and all kinds of information on radiation exposures and ways to reduce their risk. At the same time, the people who were digging the uranium up, processing the uranium, transporting the uranium, were not given that information.
In places like New Mexico.
In part, there was a differential with language because many of the miners were Navajo. Many of the miners were Native Americans. In part, it was just a classic case of environmental racism that these folks don't necessarily need to know. With the uranium miners studies, it's important to understand that the U.S. was the primary buyer, the U.S. government, But they had leased the rights out to a private corporation, and it was the corporation who, in their deal with the United States, got them to say, you can study our workers, but we don't want you to let them have the information about their health risks because we don't want to lose our workers. So the U.S. made that sort of deal in the economic and national security interest, I suppose one might argue. From a human experience, it meant that people would be working for decades. They could be studied. They could have emerging lung cancers occurring, and they would not be informed.
The fact is that not only Native Americans here, but Native and Indigenous people all over the world have borne the brunt of the nuclear radiation problem.
Yeah, when you look at where uranium has been mined around the world, about 70% or so, a study was done in the 90s that showed about 70% of the where uranium was mined was on Indigenous land. And certainly when you look at where weapons are tested, it's in the middle of nowhere from power elite point of view. You don't test in downtown Washington, D.C. So, yes.
If you're a native of those places, it's the center of everywhere.
Exactly. It's those folks who are living in the margins that end up bearing the brunt. What's important to understand in terms of this story with, for example, uranium mining is that in the 70s, occupational health and safety standards were finally legislated and imposed, and conditions have improved. In the 90s, the uranium market, for a lot of reasons having to do with Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and the demise of nuclear energy at that point, uranium became I think $6 a pound in 1990. The market dropped out. Very little activity occurred. In the last couple of years, though, we've had this boom in uranium mining, in part because of a renewed interest in nuclear energy, and in part because of nuclear militarism. As mining occurs in the United States, it occurs under a regulatory oversight to some degree or another. As it occurs elsewhere in the world, it's more questionable. And the point I wanted to make is that if you go, for example, to the Congo today, where we first got our uranium for the Manhattan Project, you've got illegal mines working with warlords using slave labor. You're talking horrific abuses now and down the line.
On every level.
On every level, as a result of the fact that uranium is so incredibly valuable now. If it was just, it's last time I checked, it was $95 a pound, but it just keeps going up and up and up. It's skyrocketing on order of magnitude that no other commodity is skyrocketing. And in part, it's similar to the story of blood diamonds in terms of what's happening if you're looking at uranium and uranium deposits in Africa, and uranium deposits in Guatemala, in Australia. Because of the change in value, groups that had lived with uranium, and in Australia is a really good case, Aboriginals who'd been living with uranium mining tailings, with the long-term legacies of mining in the 50s and 60s, and struggling with the health effects, were very radicalized and informed and aggressive in protesting expansion of uranium in the last couple of years. However, as the price has gone up for uranium, you're starting to see in certain places and cases where groups are 180% changing their point of view because of the economic opportunity. So it's a very scary and difficult situation if you're concerned about the health effects of unleashing this.
Now, let's go back to the Cold War for a moment. Public relations was very much a part of the entire nuclear project in the United States at that time. And as you point out, the effort was to reassure people about radiation rather than to inform them. What was the nature of the half-truths put out by the government PR people?
Well, basically, as I said earlier, the idea that radiation is natural, you don't need to be afraid of it. It's a good thing. That at certain levels it can be harmful, but if you just have the right kind of information, you can protect yourself from the risk. It placed all of the emphasis on protection on the individual rather than on government. So if you were downwind from nuclear weapons tests, as just about everybody on the planet was at one level or another, but in more intensive ways, as certainly Colorado and Utah and the Dakotas and New York because of atmospheric winds and so forth.
And New Mexico.
And New Mexico. If you're downwind, then the emphasis on radiation is natural. You don't need to be scared. Just go to your bomb shelter or do things to reduce your exposures, on an emphasis response of the individual's responsibility. But the government didn't have responsibility. They didn't have responsibility. Oftentimes, they did not warn people when tests were going to occur. They did not evacuate people. In some places, releases of isotopes from, for example, Hanford were purposefully done so that they could figure out how radiation would affect the food chain, and people were purposefully studied so we could see what happens to the human body. So there was, on the one hand, a very public effort to say, this is fine. On the other hand, of course, they're documenting all of the very many reasons why it's not fine. And I think the Marshall Islands is a really good example of this, ways in which half-truths were used. In the Marshall Islands in 1954, we tested our largest hydrogen weapon, the Bravo test, and it was much bigger than anticipated, a huge weapon that ended up exposing the whole nation, blanketing the whole nation, it turns out we've learned now.
The whole nation, the United States?
The whole Marshall Islands nation.
Okay.
Which is an area about the size of Mexico in terms of where all of the islands are situated and then the oceans that they cover. The test itself, of course, created a huge fallout cloud that went around the world and blanketed the world. But in terms of local fallout, the whole nation was exposed. The U.S. acknowledged that the fallout cloud went over the atoll of Rongelap and Utrecht. It also, in their documents, went over Likiyip and Watho and Kwajalein and many of the other atolls in the Marshall Islands. The U.S. evacuated, after several days, people from Rongelap, and also soldiers that had been stationed on Rongerik. They were there to monitor radiation fallout. And word got out about a week later. It was published in Life magazine that this test unintentionally exposed these people. It also, there was a Japanese fishing boat working in the area that was caught up in the fallout cloud. The point I wanted to make is that the U.S., because the news leaked out, acknowledged that these people were exposed, but then went to great efforts as months went by to document their illnesses and problems and communicate to the world that there was no lasting effect. And for decades, the case of the people of Rongelap and what their health issue might be was part of the broader political context of whether or not in the United Nations a nuclear weapons test ban would go through. So it was in the U.S. interest at the time to make sure that test ban did not go through, and they did everything in their power to define the science and to document conditions in ways that demonstrated that people are fine, people are healthy, there's no lasting effects, acute exposures, radiation burns and so forth were just minor and did not pose, no one died from these events. If you go through the records, you'll find a different story. I was just going through declassified records a couple weeks ago, and I found when the people of Utrecht were exposed, 2 days, 3 days later, a ship came to evacuate them, and I found the memorandum of record for this evacuation. So they're moving people off the island, and one of the important things is to figure out how many people are here. Did we get everybody? Are we leaving anybody behind? And they had quite a difficult time trying to figure out how many people were on Utrecht, because initially they were told one number, and then they realized the number included people who were living in their mother's bellies. The Marshallese counted the unborn as humans as well, and so that was part. So then they adjusted their figures, and they were still off, and they realized it was because there was two babies who had died in the days since the fallout started. So in other words, died after the tests. They were newborns, and they died in the 2 days that the people of Utrecht were on island. Those babies were never documented or counted in the record as being any possible fatality. The only kinds of when you have a fatality, it's only real if it's been documented. So that's one of the aspects of the half-truths. From the point of view of people who live there and their experiences, their understanding is very different.
Tell us about the medical tests that led to the banning of atmospheric nuclear tests. I mean, they were harvesting the teeth of children, people under 30, babies, who died from radiation poisoning.
Well, there was a whole series of tests. Initially, the United States set up something called the Project Gabriel, which then led to Project Sunshine. Because of their concerns of strontium and the high levels of strontium that were being released around the world, they started setting up in countries around the world monitoring stations to see where is this. And then they started, because of their fears of how strontium adheres to calcium, collecting samples. And so they, through relationships with doctors and governments and missionaries, they obtained bone samples of recently deceased people, including fetuses from spontaneous abortions and things that might have occurred from radiation exposure. And they were trying to understand where around the world is it, how much strontium has gotten into the human body, what kind of health effects might be occurring. Again, it was a documentation effort, a monitoring, rather than a preventative, let's reduce hazard, let's reduce risk approach. So that was one set of studies. Some of the other studies, as it became more and more obvious that fallout was causing a biological impact and that was affecting human populations, they were forced from public outcry as much as anything, the United States, to study, for example, the large number of sheep that died in the 50s and to study how, for example, iodine, radioiodine might be affecting people. Documenting with radioiodine the bioaccumulation in cows and in milk and thus the exposure to children, but not necessarily giving that information to the public. You know, I mean, mothers across the country would have changed their child's uptake of milk if they knew that they were feeding their children radioactive and dangerous substances.
And some of those children were going to die of it.
Right. Oh, yes.
I think it's very important to, probably some of our listeners have heard of this, but to tell people about the 2005 finding that was released by the National Academy of Sciences, namely that there's no threshold of radiation exposure below which radiation can be really considered safe and harmless.
Yeah, that was the BEER-7 report. It's a committee that was established by the National Academy of Sciences to examine this whole question of the human health effects of radiation. And while scientists have put out that theory for decades and had their science censored and had their jobs curtailed and their political fallout, you know, certainly was extreme. What's so significant about this study is that it's not just individual scientists who are making these claims or presenting the information. Instead, it's a scientific consensus that the wealth of information demonstrates that there is no threshold in which below that radiation is a good, that it at any level that radiation can cause abnormal cellular growth. And a lot of our understanding, again, of that, the reasons why BEER-7 came out with this rather than BEER-1, is because of Chernobyl and what we've learned from Chernobyl. One of the more, there's a gazillion studies that have occurred as a result of Chernobyl exposures, but one of the more significant ones, I think, is a study of workers who were involved in the cleanup. And there was 10,000 workers who were had children before they went on service as a Chernobyl worker cleanup and had children afterwards. And so the study looked at
men and women?
Just men, and let's look at their offspring. And what they found was with children born before and children born after, that there was a statistically significant change in the germ cell, in their DNA, and that was being passed along, that the father's exposure created a significantly statistical change to the point that the next generation has received a mutation as a result of that exposure. That kind of number and that kind of study, we did not have confirmation. We had suggestion. We had it in animal studies. We didn't have confirmation in human studies before Chernobyl.
And what kind of exposures were these people getting? I mean, were they relatively low levels of radiation?
Well, it's a good question. In terms of, again, the theories are, well, maybe the practice over the decades has been to say that the only exposures of concern are exposures over a certain level, a certain dose. So it has been very important, for example, to document your dose so you could thus predict what kind of health outcome you might have. What this BEER study showed in the BEER-7 study was that actually low levels, it depends upon on the type of isotope, that low levels can have different kinds of outcomes. So if you're exposed to one type of isotope, for example, say you're exposed to radioiodine, a low level might have no effect at all. It's the high level that would be of great concern. Other types of isotopes act differently in the body, and that's something we're just starting to understand, that isotopes go to different parts of the body, can be situated differently. You can have a whole system exposure, or you can have just a specific organ.
We're talking to Barbara Rose Johnston. The book is called Half Lives, Half Truths, Confronting the Radioactive Legacies of the Cold War. You were talking about the censorship of science a moment ago. Tell us about Earl Reynolds.
Earl Reynolds is an anthropologist, physical anthropologist, that was brought into the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission in 1951 to help document what happens to children when they're exposed. In this case, it was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they were looking at children who had been exposed and children who lived in the same area but not as close to ground zero. And he was, as a physical anthropologist, measuring skeletal growth, skeletal change, and documenting the physical effects. And what he documented was that exposures not only to the initial blast, but exposures to fallout in the area produced severe stunting in the next generation of children, or children growing up in that contaminated setting. That over time there was obvious and overwhelming data to demonstrate that children being exposed to this were shorter, that their bones were shorter, that there was also a mental as well as physical stunting that was occurring. This evidence he wrote up in a whole series of reports and submitted them to the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission and then of course the U.S. government for review and whether or not they'd be released. And he and his family then went off in 1956 for a voyage around the world. They built a sailboat when they lived in Japan, and they went for a very well-publicized voyage around the world. It was a traditional Japanese wooden sailboat, and when they went around the world and they ended back up in Hawaii in 1958, they were entered the Oahu harbor at a time when Quakers had tried to stop the nuclear weapons testing in 1958 in the Marshall Islands. About a month before, a family had sailed into the Marshall Islands zone with the hope of interrupting the tests. They were arrested. So Earl Reynolds' family was sort of, they didn't realize the testing was still going on. They also didn't realize, and they didn't find out until that 1958 date, that Earl's study had been suppressed, had been indeed censored, that had never come out. They had hoped that this evidence would put a halt to nuclear weapons testing. Instead, what they found out, that not only was his study withheld, it was his findings were discredited. At least the word was put out that the data was not sound. In later years, he found that was not true. So Earl Reynolds and his family decided that they would take up the Quaker challenge, and they sailed in to the Marshall Islands in 1958, and also, similarly, were arrested. And he was tried and sentenced, and then went through a very, again, well-publicized series of appeals that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Ended up winning his case, that the U.S. had no right under the law of the sea to arrest and halt their entry. And while he spent many, many years in court fighting this and became one of the world's first nuclear activists as a result, his life was forever changed. He never got a job again after that in a tenured university environment. He certainly was not able to get funding to continue his very important research on the effects of fallout on children. And more importantly, that his data was suppressed. So it wasn't for decades that we learned that exposure to fallout would cause this problem in children. In fact, it was documented by Sutow, a Nisei doctor, Japanese-American doctor, who worked with the Marshallese population in the late 60s, a good 10 years later. So a whole population of Marshallese were unnecessarily affected as a result of this censorship.
It reminds one of some of the global warming censorship.
Very much so. I think, again, it's important to understand that, you know, nations take actions on the basis of economic and political interests, and where the debate lies is the morality when you're saying national or economic and security interests supersede human experience, and the human rights aspects of this case is just appalling.
Tell us about the work of Edith Turner.
Edith Turner is an anthropologist who, she's British, was born and raised in the UK, and in the 50s, as a young mother, lived downwind of Sheffield, of an area where nuclear weapons manufacturing was occurring. There was an unintentional release, and she was exposed. Her first child was born severely deformed. This is a little fact that you only find if you read the footnote in her chapter. In the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, she was working in Alaska, and she was working with Alaskan populations. And as a traditional anthropologist initially, in the sense of, let's document your health, your culture, your way of life, isn't sort of the armchair tourism approach to culture. And what she started seeing was cancer clusters, huge outbreak of health crises and kinds of health issues that had never occurred before. With her Alaskan counterparts, she helped document a serious problem emerging in terms of different types of radiogenic cancers, and forcing the government to look at the areas where these people live, and discovering that there were that these health outcomes were likely the end consequence of Cold War era experiments like tracking radiation through the food chain and through the human body, planting heavily contaminated soils. Some soils were brought up from the Nevada test site and planted in this area of Alaska to see what would happen. This was an area where Teller had proposed doing peaceful uses of the nuclear weapon to create a new harbor. So there was a lot of work along the lines. It was a project that eventually was squelched because of protest in Alaska. Three tests took place in Alaska. So there's for a whole number of reasons people were experiencing health outcomes. Because of Edith's working with the people to communicate their lived human experience, they were able to get political attention in Washington, D.C., and National Academy of Science investigation and congressional action that took place. And again, it was as much as anything because the human story came out, in contrast to the official scientific definition as framed by the government at the time.
I mean, I think if there's anything that your book tells us over and over again is the importance of telling the story and the importance of making it public.
Yeah. Well, these events are real. And, you know, everyone's aware, of course, that reality is in the eye of the beholder, and that reality can be shaped and fashioned and articulated in ways to serve different kinds of interests. But one of the reasons why the human story, especially with a nuclear war machine, is so important to consider is given where we are in the world now and where we're going. When you talk to the Marshallese, it's really an interesting situation. It's most polluted place on the planet as a result of nuclear weapons testing. The whole nation is severely affected. You have the highest cancer rates for many types of cancer in the world in this region. You do not have a single oncologist. You do not have a national study that's studying the cancer rates. Healthcare system is just abysmal. It's an independent nation, but when all of the nuclear weapons tests occurred, they were a territory of the United States, just as Puerto Rico is, just as the Virgin Islands is, just as Guam is, just as Alaska was. So as territorial citizens of the United States, this was the context of their exposures. So they have horrific problems, and they have horrific experiences. I know so many women who've never been able to give a viable offspring and have given birth to horrific realities, just horrific. You can't call them babies. Just horrible stories. And yet when you talk to them about why is it the Marshall Islands are such good friends to the United States, and they are, oftentimes the answer you'll get is, well, the U.S. didn't start this. The Japanese started the war, and the weapons were a result of the Japanese and what the Japanese were doing. Marshall Islands was occupied by Japan during World War II. So, it's a real interesting situation where it's a very complicated reality. People's understanding of their problems and their issues and their pains, yet at the same time their love and affinity for the United States is real.
Let's talk for a moment about depleted uranium. Depleted uranium is a byproduct of enriching uranium. Is it bad for you?
depends on who you talk to. It really depends on who you talk to. Depleted uranium is extremely long-lived isotope. It's a very, very, very heavy, heavy metal, and it's quite useful, it turns out, in terms of being able to create shielding, for example, for our soldiers. So when you listen to all of the concerns of being involved in an armed conflict, having shielding, whether you're wearing shielding on as part of your uniform or shielding on your vehicle, involves depleted uranium. If you're flying up in the airplane, you're flying typically in an airplane that has a chunk of depleted uranium serving as a counterweight of balance. If you're using munitions in many parts of the world, you're using munitions that are tipped, such as bullets or missiles and so forth, that are tipped with uranium. Because besides being a really useful and strong metal in terms of shielding, it also has this property of basically being able, like a knife cut through butter, it can just go right through. You shoot a depleted uranium tipped rocket through a Humvee, and it will go all the way through the vehicle to the other side, might even hit the next one over. So it has phenomenal properties from a military point of view. The issues, of course, it's a very, very, very long-lived, meaning it's a radioactive but a low-level radioactive isotope. And the issues are what happens when you are exposed to the dust or to the shrapnel associated with depleted uranium. Because it has such a long half-life, that means that it will take many decades before a derivative effect to occur. So again, it depends on who you talk to in terms of its health consequence. One of the things that we've studied a lot is the radioactive aspect of it. One of the things we have not studied is what are the other toxic aspects of exposure to this element. So increasingly, there's been some suggestion in the literature that neurotoxins, for example, that exposure to dust or to shrapnel can lead to a neurological effect because of the nature, not just the radioactive nature of it, but also the other toxic aspects of this element. Increasingly, we're seeing the same kinds of offspring of reproductive problems that we've seen with nuclear weapons tests occurring in areas where depleted uranium has been used on the battlefield. So in Bosnia and Kosovo, in Iraq from the first Gulf War, cancer clusters and birth defects are occurring at rates that were previously unknown. Our science, at least in terms of the U.S. science and the approach traditionally, has been, let's look for a direct cause and effect. And if it can't find a direct cause and effect, then it's not, we can't say with assured confidence that this is real. In the last few years, many scientists have moved to let's look at the experience, let's look at what we know about the issue, and perhaps take preventative. Even if we don't know all aspects of the science, we could take a preventative approach. So that's why I said it depends on who you talk to. Personally, I believe it's a huge problem. Personally, I would not want that stuff in my body, and I would not want my children exposed to it, and I would be very, very fearful of what kind of child I would have as a result of that exposure.
Good science is objective, it's non-political, and yet we see a lot of politicized science. You use the term military-industrial academic complex. What do you mean by that?
Well, just that all science is political. All science is you can't be objective if your funding is coming from one source or another. If it's not your own original source of funding, then the question is who's funding you and why. The military-industrial academic complex in large part refers to the ways in which government needed science to be done to support certain sets of its interests, especially after World War II, when we realized the nature of war had changed. Yet right after World War II, all of our scientists who were working for the military were decommissioned, and the government did not have the money to continue the same level of science, such as the Manhattan Project, after World War II. So finding ways to run money and to define and shape those questions through the universities became a real paramount issue in the late 40s. Setting up commissions and funding mechanisms that allowed the military to say, here's a question we need answered. What happens? Can our pilots fly for 12 hours at a time at high altitude with nuclear weapons on board? What are the effects of high-level exposure? What's the effects of altitude on the human body? That's a question they needed answered, and as a result, funding is created. This government also helped create research centers at numerous universities in the United States, and then through the Atoms for Peace program that Eisenhower helped set up at institutions around the world. So cooperative relationships formed where we have an issue, we're going to give you money, you guys go out and figure it out, report back to us. When you look at some of the science that was done in the Cold War, it's not uncommon to see, you know, you sign a security agreement to use this money and to do this work. You turn in not only your findings but also your notes. And it may be decades later you still don't have access to your own work because it is classified. So that's what it is that I meant.
I think one of the big discussions that comes out of this has to do with, first of all, the basic human right to live in the planet and right of all of other living things to live without assault, and then the right to access and use information, which you were just talking about, but it's much bigger than just that aspect of science.
The fundamental human right is the right to life, and that is the right which all other rights derive. So in that sense, nuclear issues are hit at the heart and core of what it is when we articulate human rights.
In a way, it's so big and so terrifying and so invisible and so much larger than human scale that it's hard to comprehend, and it takes living with this, reading a book like this, reading it again, thinking about it, talking about it with people to make it real, especially if it hasn't affected you or seemingly hasn't affected you directly.
When you talk to people who've lived in these situations, when you talk, for example, to the Marshallese, who've lived in the most compromised of settings, it's not only your own life that's affected, it's one, two, three, four generations and beyond that you see suffering and dealing with these issues. One of the most important things for these people is to have their story documented and to have their lessons learned. So one of the real pleasures in working on this subject has been to work with people who have survived, who are struggling, who are looking for ways of how do we continue to live, how do we reduce our risk, how can we live in this setting that we love so, even if it is contaminated, how can we understand the nature of contamination? So if the problem of nuclear militarism from these host communities' point of view has been nuclear militarism and all of the invisible ways in which radiation might create new taboos, you're not even aware that are out there and you don't understand it. The answer from these people's point of view is to give us the knowledge, give us the information, help us understand what is dangerous, what is not, what can we do to reduce our risk. So some of the more exciting aspects of doing this kind of work has been figuring out ways for people to live in the parts of the world that are so contaminated, but live in a way where they understand where the threats are and they can do things to reduce their risk. That means maybe not eating this, or in the Marshalls, one of the suggestions people had is if our soil is so heavily contaminated and if the radiation gets into the food, why don't we make hydroponic gardens? Why don't we farm in the soil and grow it in a different medium? So there are solutions that people on the ground want to be involved in. It's a very difficult situation when all of the science is controlled by outsiders and all of the solutions are proposed and defined by outsiders, and you, the resident, have no understanding of what's going on and no participation. One of the more exciting projects that's occurring here in New Mexico is out on the Navajo Reservation with the Southwest Center in partnership. A number of environmental health studies that have been established, monitoring, surveying where are risks in people that live next door to tailings and so forth. And what's exciting about it is not so much the science as the participation of residents in helping you define the science. So the citizen involvement in the science, which takes it to a whole other level. It means that you have transparency, you have accountability, you're developing capacity, so.
Well, Barbara Rose Johnson, unfortunately it's time to go. Thank you so much for being with us and talking about your marvelous book, Half Lives and Half Truths, Confronting the Radioactive Legacies of the Cold War.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. My name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.